This is Ladson Hinton, Humor and Transcendence, April 13th, 2002.
I gave my first paper on humor and transcendence when I just finished analytical training in 1976. My first paper I ever gave at a national meeting. It's in Asilomar, California. But all the eminent authorities I'd revered all my life were all in the front row staring at me, and I was highly nervous, and there was a phone over there, and all of a sudden the phone rang. And, you know, it was quite startling, you know, because it wasn't supposed to ring. But luckily, my sense of humor was with me, and I said, well, I just asked for a quick call in case I wanted to get the hell out of here before I started. So we cracked up, but I found that we started laughing, and Edward Ettinger saved me. He came up and clapped me on the back, and he said he was afraid everyone was going to start laughing so much. We'll talk about laugh epidemics later, that I wouldn't be able to continue, and all, which actually might have been the best thing to do. Probably the best lecture I would have ever given if we just all laughed. So this is kind of a return to a couple of old subjects, because the next first international paper I gave 2 years later was on the Fool Archetype, which tomorrow I'm going to talk about at the workshop, talk about the Fool and more the transcendent quality of the Fool and that sort of thing. So papers on humor tend to become stuffily serious, so I don't know, we may fall into that, I hope not, but I don't know, just do something silly if it gets too bad, you know. But there are some funny things, I think, that I will talk about. Laughter is powerful and mysterious. When we laugh with others, we feel closer, and when we are laughed at or feel we might be, we feel dread. Laughter can be a transcendent experience, or it can humiliate. As Baudelaire wrote, "The wise man never laughs but that he trembles." An Egyptian alchemist, Papyrus, from the 3rd century, described the myth of creation from laughter. When God laughed, 7 gods were born to rule the world. When he burst out laughing, there was light. He burst out laughing for the 2nd time, the waters were born. At the 7th birth of laughter, the soul appeared. Laughter is an ordinary experience that can transcend the ordinary. Most laughter doesn't occur as a result of telling jokes or stories, although most papers are written as if that were true. As a matter of fact, when examined out of context, most recorded experiences of laughter are not funny at all, just from the words. There is obviously some deeper motivation than just mere wordplay. We generally feel good when we laugh. We feel closer to others when we laugh with them. We can go beyond our narcissistic foibles and defenses. As a matter of fact, life without laughter is hardly imaginable. It's a primordial experience that lies close to the basis of existence. Jokes and humorous stories are culturally developed forms using the play of language to provoke laughter. Humor comes from the idea of humors and the humoral theory of human physiology. Air, earth, fire, water, bile, phlegm, and so forth. From this origin, one sees that humor involves liquidity. Humor and laughter make us more fluid, flowing, juicy. Bergson once said that laughter removes the crust of the mechanical from the living. And I've always loved that phrase. He has a little small book just on laughter that captures the essence of this. What makes laughter so invigorating is the sense of freedom it brings, the sense of transcendence of our usual defensiveness. That's what makes humor so beloved, because they give us access to that. As a purely physiologic term, humor originally denoted mainly individual temperament, sanguine, phlegmatic, or melancholic, or whatever. It had a concrete sense of the natural character of the person. A sense of humor as a quality of personality is a fairly recent concept. This is not an old idea. It slowly emerged since the 16th century. I mean, there are ideas of the comic, but the idea of the person who has a sense of humor is such. During the 18th and 19th centuries, it evolved to mean a personality trait that an individual had, especially in the form of wit. Physiology gave way to psychology as the age of enlightenment and ethos of the individual grew. In the modern era, there's been a continuing expansion of the interior isolated self with its quality of wit or humor, although a sense of humor still certainly carries some of the original connotation of fluidity and movement. As we will see, there were potent cultural forms that created occasions of laughter and celebration at earlier times in history. These were strongly based in folk beliefs dating back hundreds or probably thousands of years. Science and technology have not been able to say, amazingly, definitively, why we laugh or how laughter itself originated. It's a mystery. There's been remarkably little writing on the subject. That's why it's kind of nice to give a talk on it or write about it, you know. But you don't have to read 10,000 books, but maybe only be familiar with a couple of dozen or something. Only humans laugh, although our chimp friends seem to have some kindred experience. However, those who listen to the sound of recorded chimp laughter without observing their behavior can't identify it as laughter. Evidently, it sounds very rough. Human laughter involves inhaling and holding the breath. That's when you speak, you inhale, and then you speak out. Whereas chimps make their sounds with both an in and an out movement of breath that sounds rough to the human ear. There are some interesting behavioral and physiologic parameters of human laughter. It's, of course, an intensely embodied experience. The pattern of laughter itself seems to be inborn, although its manifestations may be socially conditioned. Deaf and blind children laugh, and twin studies give anecdotal evidence that patterns of laughter are inherited. There was a famous set of giggle twins in a famous Minnesota twin study. These were raised apart for 40 years, both by rather dour and undemonstrative adoptive parents. Until they met each other, these twins were each regarded as mega laughers in their own environment. They'd never met anyone in their lives who had laughed so much as they did as individuals. Their laughter and testing had similar sounds and patterns, and they shared a readiness to laugh and even a taste in their kind of humor. Laughter is, of course, very social from the beginning. The smile response of the infant is a very early survival mechanism. As we know, the baby responds with a smile when it makes eye contact with its mother, and who can resist an infant's smile? A strong smile has definite survival value. Tickling, laughter stimulated by tactile contact, is connected with the development of laughter in the sense of play. This is true for chimps as well as humans. In humans, socially stimulated laughter occurs around 3.5 to 4 months of age, and tickling soon thereafter. As you know, you cannot tickle yourself, implying that differentiation of self and skin boundaries is involved in tickling. It's an intimate undertaking. We're usually particular about who we allow to tickle us. Tickling is usually playful, although like laughter, it can have an aggressive or a derisive component. It seems to have developmental value through teaching subtleties of approach avoidance behavior and skin contact and delineating a sense of self. Laughter carries this into the broader social sphere. It brings about cooperative behavior, perhaps because it makes other people feel good and enhances the sense of self. The capacity to get the other to laugh or to laugh together seems important in both mating and friendships. Like this is a quality often, if you see singles things, often it's mentioned. You want someone with a sense of humor, or I have a sense of humor, or it's a desirable characteristic too. People rarely laugh alone, and eye contact with familiar friends is often quite sufficient to provoke a lot of laughter. Laughing together increases and strengthens the bonds of relationship, and this is of lifelong significance. Laughter is under very loose conscious control and is quite contagious. Laughter triggers laughter. One can hardly resist participating in the laughter of groups, and there are records of laugh epidemics. I'll tell you about a laugh epidemic, the famous laugh epidemic. In Tanganyika, now Tanzania, in 1962, there was an outbreak of contagious laughter on a large scale. This began at a mission boarding school for girls between the ages of 12 and 18. It's pretty fun. This was at Kinshasa Village, about 25 miles from Bukoba, near Lake Victoria. The first symptoms appeared on January 30th when three girls started laughing. The symptoms of laughing, crying, and agitation quickly spread to 95 of the 159 students, forcing the school to close on March 18th. The school reopened on May 21st, but closed it again after another 57 pupils were stricken. Individual laugh attacks lasted from minutes to a few hours and recurred up to four times. Although temporarily debilitating, the laugh attacks produced no fatalities or permanent after effects. The teachers reported students being unable to attend to their lessons for several weeks after a laugh episode. The affected girls were highly agitated and often required restraint. None of the teachers, two Europeans and three Africans, were affected. However, this was not the end of the matter. When the schools were closed, laughing attacks then occurred in the home village itself of Kinshasa. 217 in the village were affected, mostly young adults and school children of both genders. Then another outbreak occurred then at a Raman Shenyi girls' school a few miles away. This school also had to close in mid-June. 48 of the 154 girls were overcome with laughter. And then another village 20 miles away was said of another outbreak. And one of the Rama Shenyi girls seemed to be the source of the contagion she had visited there. The epidemic did not abate until 2.5 years later, in June 1964. It forced the closing of more than 14 schools and affected about 1,000 people. Quarantine of affected villages seemed to be the only way of blocking the epidemic's advance. Fathers, village headmen, policemen, teachers, and other authorities were not affected. They couldn't have any fun. We have all probably experienced, we'll probably just not experience a little bit, the many epidemics of laughter. I'm sure you've experienced that. Most of us have had fits of uncontrollable laughter. I can remember as a teenager, I started laughing so much when I first, you know the movie Mr. Hulot's Holiday? When I first saw that movie, I just started laughing so much. I had a fit. I fell on the floor in the theater, right? These are laughing jags. Innocent bystanders are often sucked into this, of course. Emotions are all contagious, and of course, laughter is obviously no exception. Jung pointed this out in some of his early writings when he used to write more about emotions and kind of everyday things. How emotions are quickly and automatically transmitted to those around us. It's wonderful descriptions of that, how emotions are transferred to other members of the herd very quickly. The general position of laughter in the human condition has received far less attention than it deserves. Mikhail Bakhtin was a Russian scholar who wrote extensively about laughter. This was a daring interest since he lived during the Stalinist era, a paranoid time not at all prone to humor. He was especially interested in the meaning of laughter in medieval and Renaissance times and how this changed, like many things, with the Enlightenment. Bakhtin described laughter in medieval times as a sort of transcendent experience known through festival and celebration. This was not transcendence in the aerial sense of going above and beyond, but something earthy and immediate, dissolving artificial boundaries, opening one to the core of the embodied self. Bakhtin said some very wonderful things about laughter. It is precisely laughter that destroys any hierarchical distance. As a distance image, the subject cannot be comical. To be made comical, it must be brought close. Everything that is comical is close at hand. Laughter has the remarkable power of making the world come closer, of drawing it into a zone of crude contact, where one can finger it familiarly on all sides, turn it upside down, inside out, peer at it from above and below, break open its shell, look into its center, doubt it, take it apart, dismember it, lay it bare, expose it, examine it freely, and experiment with it. Laughter is a vital factor, a prerequisite for fearlessness, without which it would be impossible to approach the world realistically. As it draws the object to itself and makes it familiar, laughter delivers the object into the hands of free fantasy. Delivers the object into the hands of free fantasy. Bakhtin seems to be saying that the being of objects, the dimensionality of things, is disclosed through laughter. Laughter removes the crust of our mechanical ways of seeing and experiencing. It collapses our hierarchical thinking and hierarchical distancing, rather, and brings us up close. This closeness is typical of laughter. It frees us to be playful with the objects of our world in a renewed and creative way. This resembles to me, I thought, of Heidegger's description of the moment of vision when the human situation, our Dasein, being there, stands out in all its potentiality for being. As Heidegger says, this is a primordial experience of the present in all its fullness, like a homecoming to being, often filled with joy. Deep laughter can open us to such transcendent experiences. The Judeo-Christian tradition has generally been one of suspicion towards laughter. In the Old and New Testaments, there's little mention of laughter. A theologian once had a discussion, and she gave me only a little more than half a sheet of paper with every reference, and mostly the Old Testament and in Psalms. And the institutional church tended to follow that line. During medieval times, people mostly experienced laughter in festivals and other activities outside the structures of organized religion. There's freedom in laughter that can be subversive. To the institutional church's way of thinking, laughter was the province of paradise. This was the way it was explained. Laughter was the province of paradise. You could laugh there, and laughter on earth was presumptuous and perhaps a temptation of the devil. Indeed, there is a bit of both heaven and hell in laughter. Tears and laughter are closely connected. Laughter has a destructive side, too, that we fear. To be the object of ridicule or derision is a fearsome thing. There were Native American shamans who specialized in ridiculing the enemy on the battlefield, thus robbing them of their potency. And there's some really hilarious descriptions of these things that they would say. You know, their enemy would be in proximity and they would just lose their power through this ridicule. Charlie Chaplin, I don't know if you've ever seen, you know, his movies of the Little Dictator, depotentiated the power of Hitler in a remarkable way to me. I mean, people forget that at that time, the Little Dictator was thought that Hitler was invincible and that World War II, even if it was won, would probably take 2 to 3 decades, the war. And who of World War II generation, Spike Jones, but I know my favorite song as a kid was Spike Jones when I was, one of these songs that said, when the Fuhrer says, we is the master race, we high up, right in the Fuhrer's face. And there was a folksier British version of this, I can't do a Cockney accent, but I'll try. It said, whistle while you work. Hitler is a twerp. He is balmy, so's his army. Whistle while you work. I love that. He is balmy, so's his army. There's a power in laughter that can be frightening, though. As we laugh, we flirt with the unknown in ways that make us uneasy. Barnaby Barrett has said the joke flirts with the crack or the abyss that underlies our cleverest language. Humor is often a flirtation with uncertainty. It makes us anxiously wonder if our language, our words and symbols can indeed contain the enigmatic reality, capital R, at the core of existence. This creates the tension that's so often a part of humor. On the other hand, humor and laughter can open new dimensions in a transcendent way. Referring to this fact, Barrett quotes the Leonard Cohen song, "There's a crack in everything, and that's how the light gets in." There's a crack in everything, and that's how the light gets in. The Rosh Shamra texts may be the earliest records of ritual laughter. They date from about the 14th century B.C. These texts tell of an early Phoenician Canaanite cult drama that celebrated the simultaneous death and rebirth of the vegetation god Baal, god of rainfall and fertility, with tales of weeping and laughing. I have to confide in you, this was another humorous thing from my adolescence. Some of my buddies and I, we had this secret call that we made to each other, that when we greet each other, we'd say, "Hail Baal, Hail Baal." So we had this kind of secret cult around. Somebody had read somewhere about this mysterious god named Baal. But this cult, 14th century B.C., migrated not only into the land of Canaan, but eventually worked its way from the Nile to the Euphrates, far north into Asia Minor, and much further west, too. In all those places, people wept and wailed over the death of the gods as they buried them in the ground, and laughed and rejoiced at the very same time in anticipation of their eventual resurrection and ultimate marriage to the complementary goddesses. The goal of these ceremonies was union and harmony, the marriage of opposites, not so different than the marriage of light and dark, like in one of Shakespeare's comedies. These events were reenacted during an autumnal festival that welcomed the wet season over the dry, in which Baal reigned as the god of fertility. The tribe symbolically buried Baal in the fall to ensure his rebirth in the rains of the springtime. You should recall, since we live in a different culture, that this was indeed a life or death matter, for a failure of rain and of the crops could lead to starvation and death. They didn't have any frozen food supplies. As Baal was lowered into his underground home, the witnesses to his burial wept and lamented his departure. They wondered in dread, would he ever reappear? Would rain and a bountiful harvest indeed replenish the earth? Since the participants did indeed hope and believe that he would eventually return, they would periodically break out in fits of laughter, a joyous counterpart to their sadness. And so there was a rich mixture of grief, dread, and laughter. Laughter was a rich harbinger of the regenerative powers of nature. Everyday humor often involves, in my opinion, a small ritual enactment that, strangely enough, I think is similar to this in its contours, similar to this death and rebirth cycle of Baal. Just thinking of everyday humor, some of the basic elements are, first, when you're hearing a humorous story, you just perk up and you get engaged. But there's a preliminary tension, a fear that you won't get it. There's a little anxiety, and that you might fall into abyss or be drowned in shame or dread, or there's some kind of tension, which I make analogy with the fear that God won't return, won't be reborn. There'll be failure and a fall, just permanent staying in the pit or in the grave. Second, however, there's an air of anticipation and excitement based on the hope we will get it and experience the mysterious power of laughter, like the rebirth of the god from an endlessly fertile earth. So there's hope. We're anxious and we have hope when we listen to a story. Then when there is a sudden resolution and we do indeed get it, an earthy experience of transcendence and laughter occurs. The god returns, so to speak. We feel renewed and closer to our world, which now seems fruitful and friendly. After you laughed at a good story, or especially in a group or something, it's a good feeling. In this way, jokes and humor can take us close to the crack in the world, the underlying uncertainty of existence, and then we're relieved as the everyday ritual of humor works. Laughter renews us, regrounds us in the endless fertility at the core of existence. The carnival in Brazil creates a similar invigorating spirit. It has been interpreted through its essential opposition to the world of daily life as a kind of reversal or rebellion in which social life is turned on its head and time played back to front. It has been seen as a world of laughter, of madness, and play in which the established order of daily life dissolves in the face of an almost utopian anarchy in which all hierarchical structures are overturned and the fundamental equality of all human beings is proclaimed. Above all else, it has been understood as a celebration in which the repressions and prohibitions of normal life cease to exist and new things are suddenly possible. The oppositional elements in these events stand out. Some of the oppositions are between Lent and Carnival, between winter and summer, freedom and rules, purity versus impurity, playfulness versus seriousness, and life versus death. These are in dialogic relationships, that is, they are in endless discourse with each other. In this process, we skate through a liminal world with a strong element of uncertainty and a hint of the abyss. We often see these elements in everyday comic forms which suspend us between realities through the tension of the narrative performance. The oppositional pairings of Abbott and Costello, Laurel and Hardy, the Marx Brothers, express such tensions and conflicts. One represents the brilliant, disruptive Carnival and the other sober Lent in the usual case. If anyone recently saw the movie Chocolat, if you've seen that movie, that's a wonderful description of, and a rich one of all this interplay of these moods and forces. There are no final answer, of course, to any of these things, and it's an endless back and forth dialogue, an endless process. There's no last word about any of these things. Deriving from a view of life as a never-ending cycle, an end state of perfection does not exist in this perspective. Karl Marx will never be as quick-witted as Groucho, but we know he will always be coming up with some new challenge to the order of things, a challenge that will stimulate lively thoughts and actions. This is a world of process, or as I said, in more contemporary terms, of discourse. The oppositions between these ongoing interactions are not merely destructive or rebellious. Giving the non-establishment left-out elements a voice can both stabilize and reinvigorate the existing order. When uproarious laughter turns the world upside down, it can open new horizons and can open transcendent dimensions. A deep communal feeling can emerge from comic celebrations, enriching both the individual and the collective psyches. Mikhail Bakhtin, as I mentioned before, emphasized the profound fertility of laughter in the medieval festivals he studied. In a beautiful phrase, to me, he calls such events the second revelation of the world in play and laughter. This is another way of expressing laughter's transcendent quality. Bakhtin wrote about Rabelais, the French writer who lived from 1494 to 1553. Rabelais' Gargantua and Pantagruel appeared at a time of political and spiritual oppression. It was immediately and immensely popular. This work stands out as a monument to the ebullient peasant spirit that can at any moment turn the world on its head. In medieval times, carnival laughter focused on the belly, food and drink, breasts, buttocks, genitals, feces, urine, bladder, and so forth. It was extremely earthy and embodied. We can see this in the works, too, of artists such as Hieronymus Bosch and Bruegel the Elder. So I was looking at some paintings of Giorgione, who also kind of fits into this category a little bit later. Grotesque realism is the term Bakhtin used for the wild exaggerations and emphases, especially seen in the carnival, as well as in the writings of Rabelais. Laughter is engendered and enhanced by graphic descriptions of these earthy, surreal images. However, in contrast to the modern view, Bakhtin states, such a grotesque body is not separated from the rest of the world, and it is not a closed, completed unit. It's unfinished. It grows itself, transgresses its own limits. The stress is laid on those parts of the body and the extensions thereof that are open to the outside world, that is, the parts through which the world enters the body or emerges from it, or through which the body itself goes off to meet the world. This means the emphasis is on the apertures or the convexities, the various ramifications or offshoots, the open mouth, genital organs, phallus, breast, potbelly, the nose. The body discloses its essence as a principle of growth, which exceeds its own limits only in copulation, pregnancy, childbirth, the throes of death, eating, drinking, or defecation. This is the ever-unfinished, ever-creating body. This is somewhat reminiscent of Erich Neumann's descriptions of the body and the Great Mother in some of his other works before his very untimely death. For him, early body experiences provided the original grounding constructs of inner life, the body as container and processor of perceptual events. In his writing, the archetypes were depicted as being based upon an underlying unitary stratum of being. It was below or different than archetypes. The fertile core of the body self lies at the heart of Neumann's model of the psyche, complementing Bakhtin's more graphic affective descriptions. Here the body has a capacity for transcendence through its endless fertility and abundance, its special kind of wholeness. It is a wholeness that is endlessly in process and never completed. Its parts and their never-ending movement are experienced as constituent elements of that process rather than in isolation. As a result, there's no fear or terror in this worldview. All things have a place in their endless circulation. The smell of waste is a hint of endless fertility and creation. A huge nose can abundantly scent the rich smells of abundant life. Exaggerated genitals remind us of the boundless generative capacities of our natures, and giant bellies are the sites of mysterious transformations, just as some examples. For medieval people, the body was often depicted as two bodies in one, often simultaneously birth-giving and dying right at the same time, giving birth, being conceived, generated in barn, and aging and dying. The body was most frequently represented in immediate proximity to birth or death, to infancy or old age, to womb or grave, to the bosom that gives life or swallows it up. This is very different than the contemporary body ideal, frozen in eternal girlhood or boyhood. The preferred modern image tends to be either anorectic or have divine abs. The individual often evaluates his or her worth like a commodity being prepared or feeling unprepared for market. An obsession with health has similar roots of control sometimes and a more subtle kind of commodification. There is an illusion that more workouts, a more austere diet, or Botox treatments, if you know this, injections now with botulism toxin will take away wrinkles in the face, but it paralyzes the facial muscles, and you can end up with these strange, immobilized, mask-like faces. This is all the rage now. We got a guy waiting out here that he can give us some Botox afterwards. Botox treatment. You'll be hearing more about those. But so these to forestall the natural course of life with its endless cycle of birth, aging, and death. The sense of the boundless fertility of the body is lost in this disownment. Along with its wrinkles, the earthy round of birthing and dying has its own kind of exuberant, endless vitality. To live otherwise is to live in terror of the life process itself. Better to celebrate our endless fecundity than to protest our inevitable changes. We view the modern body as completed, finished, as essentially isolated and alone from other bodies, or we want to see it that way. The cultural image of the perfected anorectic body reflects our basic terror, as I said, of the life cycle. We disown the messiness and impurity of bodily processes. I mean, you know, probably what we spend on deodorants and health foods and dieting exceeds the national product of many countries, probably a bunch of them put together. We try to eliminate these impurities because they're evidence of our incompleteness. We smell ourselves. we're human, we're embodied, we're prone to decay and death, or and if you have the other worldview, we're fertile, it's productive somehow, it's rich. The carnival body was an open, unfinished body, always in process, dying and bringing forth an eternal abundance. It was not separated from the world by clearly defined boundaries, but blended with the world, with animals and with objects. There was an exuberant vitality in this laughing acceptance of life as an endless birth and dying, because it was able to affirm at the same time a transcendent quality of creative abundance that underlaid all the cyclic changes. From this older point of view, a fart, piece of feces, can reveal the transcendent body, its amazing capacity to turn out these things and the eternal in and out of things. And Neumann talked wonderfully, I thought, about how you put something in, and of course this is just at very early stages, and then something strange goes on, and then stuff comes out the other end. You know, the sense of the fecal gift. I'm going to talk a little bit about this tomorrow in the workshop, some studies connecting the colony of artists in India, where they had many things. A friend of mine who's now dead, the Ronaldo Madura, studied this art colony, and he found they had many things. They were laughed a lot. They were active fools, but they also extremely wild with their feces. And there's funny stories about that. Oaths and curses often evoke such a sense of earthy fertility, and these were very prevalent during medieval times and were well depicted by Rabelais, and I'm sure you may have read Chaucer. These things can reconnect us with the body as the fount of messy human creativity. They take us back inside the source of creation. The feces came from within us. Our spittle comes from within us. We produce that. That reminds us of the richness of the endless production, you know, not to speak of breast milk or birth giving or, you know, kind of more obvious creative things, but all these earthy, everyday things. So oaths, you know, that's why, you know, when you curse, I mean, it's kind of enlivening a lot of the time. They take us back inside the source of creation. Their invocation provokes a lot of gleeful laughter, too. We laugh because of this kind of sense of fertility. And in the sense of transcending for a time the terror, of course, surrounding fragmentation and mortality to which we are always prone. And we transcend this through this sense of our generativity. Contemporary jokes and comedy carry on in the spirit. Scatological comments are at the heart of much humor. Dragging things through the dirt can sometimes be freeing and invigorating. Lenny Bruce was the extreme version of this in the old days. Saturday Night Live is an ongoing depiction of these things. Toward the end of Memories, Dreams, and Reflections, Jung quoted a favorite joke. It was a story about a student who came to a rabbi and said, or student said to the rabbi, in the olden days there were men who saw the face of God. Why don't they anymore? And the rabbi replied, because nowadays, no one can stoop so low. Laughter both degrades and materializes. Degrading means here coming down to earth. The contact with the earth is an element that swallows up and gives birth at the same time. To degrade is to bury, to sow, and to kill simultaneously in order to bring forth something more and better. To degrade means also to concern oneself with the lower stratum of the body, the life of the belly and the reproductive organs. It therefore relates to acts of defecation and copulation, conception, pregnancy, and birth. Degradation digs a bodily grave for a new birth. It is not only a destructive negative aspect, but a regenerating one. To degrade an object does not imply merely hurling it into the void of non-existence, into absolute destruction, but to hurl it down to the reproductive lower stratum, the zone in which reproduction and new birth take place. Grotesque realism knows no other level. It is the fruitful earth and the womb. It is always conceiving. To the ego, however, this may feel like death, like the end of the world, like a bad joke. It's flirting with the abyss, the crack in the world. Though scatological humor and body orifices may seem gross and low to us, they're the stuff of both humor and the analytic process. The divine is found in unexpected places, not in the established ones. Sharing this basic idea, the alchemist emphasized that it is the feces or other discarded or neglected stuff that, where the gold is found. However, the alchemical descriptions often seem to me somewhat abstract and removed from human experience. In contrast, in the richly embodied stuff of emotion and laughter, we directly experience the vital transcendent core of being. So I thought it might be a good place to stop here and take a look at a few slides, and then we could take a break, and then I'll just have a fairly brief conclusion, 15 minutes or so, and then we could talk some. Is that, how long a break do you usually take? 10, 15 minutes? Or okay. So we'll do the slides then. Good. I don't have a... I guess if you can make them go, I don't have a puncher. I'll just start with... Well, here's this Neumann diagram. That's the first one. This is not very bright, I'm sorry, but here's the body. The core, mouth, breath, womb... So I cannot let the anus out, but it should sort of in there. And so all the symbols of the world and all these other symbols are derived from this core body experience, according to Neumann. There it goes. See, belly, heart, breast, mouth, breath, womb. And these, all the other symbols, archetypes, or whatever you want to say, are derived from this original kind of embodied experience. And Neumann first registered, died in the 50s, and when he's in the 50s, and he himself was in his 50s in Karrech in Israel, and I think he would have been the creative light of the next generation of Jungians if he lived. So, next one, please. This is a Morris dancer. These still exist in England. These lead the wild and crazy dances. They're connected with the Green Man in English lore. If you remember the Green Man, they go around the villages and lead wild, kind of chaotic dances. They still exist, evidently. So, the next one, please. This is just some village dance. Supposedly, this is a dance inspired by some Morris dancers. So, next one, please. This is just the Garden of Earthly Delights by Bosch. Oh, okay, thank you. So the happy scene of this is the Miser, as I recall. Death of the Miser, also by Bosch. This is typical, so this macabre little devil up here. Here's death coming in the door. Here's something down here. I don't know what that's doing. Here's a monkey-like thing. And others proudly just follow the parade and their collective roles. And this is all the... it gives you a sense, though, just this love of the macabre, the kind of the wild vitality is wonderful in this era. Also, is in the unicorn tapestries. It comes from the same time that I've lectured on other times. Next one, this haven. There's just some interesting serenaders, just some men in an egg. You got the funny hat and the owl. A little bit like a sort of a ship of fools. Here's a hand going out here. I don't know what that's doing. There's some strange monsters. Next one, please. This is just a village dance. The wedding. This is actually a wedding dance. And the idea of the vitality of the times. And this is still... No, this is now Bruegel. Bruegel. Next one, please. Another peasant dance by Bruegel. Next, please. This is called the Blue World, which, see this woman putting this blue cloak on the old man? Well, this was a clue, and I can't find out where this came from, but the Blue World was a world when everything was turned upside down. And when I lived in Bavaria for three years during Fasching, which was the pre-Lenten, very wild time in Bavaria, the Bishop of Munich actually made a public declaration that adultery was not so bad a sin during Fasching. It actually happened. It was in Munich. But they had trains. I have to say, I never had the nerve to take one, but they call them the Blaue Fahrt. And that means the blue voyage. And on these trains, you would get on and you wouldn't know where the train was going. And you would put on masks. They'd give you masks when you got on the train, and they'd have champagne and food, and just go off into the unknown and to some strange castle or someplace, and people would then stay two or three days or nights. So this Blaue Fahrt. So, it continues. It's still the blue. There's something about the blue. So this was the Blue World, and I don't know the meaning of all the goings on here. You can see the wild stuff going on. But this is, this was this magical feeling at this time in history that everything was turned upside down. Everything was possible in this ritual way. And it was so renewing, evidently, to the people, to the imagination. Next one, please. Here you can see, this is symbolic. She's putting the blue cloak over him, symbolizing this is the mood that's to rule. Look, I don't know what's going on in all this. Look at this strength. Look at this. I don't know what all these things are. That's what this guy's doing. They're doing all kinds of foolish, strange things, It's, everything is turned upside down. This guy's carrying something. He's looking up. Here's a sort of a really weird-looking guy back there. Oh, well. Next, please. This is the Carnival in Lent, as I recall. The fight between Carnival and Lent. You see over here, Lenten. Everyone's in dark robes and somber. And it's all... And here's all celebration, wild stuff, drinking, playing, dancing, this eternal kind of... But the carnival aspect is much more developed in those times than in Anatolia. Next, please. This is just more detail of the carnival and Lent. See the loyal Lenten ones. Next, please. Oh, this is called the Land of Cocaine, as I recall. Yeah, it's just kind of a time of great satiation. There are lots of, you'll see more people are kind of in big bodies and lots of food and just, even the pigs come equipped with their own carving knives here. So, next, please. I really like this one. This is by Bruegel. It's called Big Fish Eat Little Fish. I read it was an inspiration for a ballet, actually, recently. I read the review in the New York Times. I don't know what it means, but it's just the whole sense of the playfulness and kind of the grotesqueness of it all. Just the grotesque wild. See the strange going up in the air? This guy's taking a fish up on a ladder or going up or getting it down, and I don't know what this is. Hearing I just find these fantastically amusing and energizing, the images. But next one, please. This is a wild man. See, the wild man. This is from a Shrovetide folk play. The wild man of especially in Central Europe, was a man who sort of lived in trees or with trees and came in at certain times into the court. And they had I used to collect coins a long time ago, and this time they had the Wildmann-Taler, wild man and a dollar, and had these wild men all on the coin. So it was a very predominant folk theme, but they would lead these, participate in kind of wild, festive things at certain ritual times during the year. Actually, a third of the time during the year was some ritual occasion, you know, during the late medieval times. A third of the time was some kind of occasion for festival. So, next one, please. Let's see, this one, what is this one? This is called sloth. So everybody is just eating to satiation, exhausted, ruled by all these goblins. This is sloth, you know, they're all taken down to satiation. See, this one's in bed here still trying to eat and being pulled along by what, who knows what that is. Next one, please. This is the wedding of some symbolic figure, the wedding of Moxus. It's kind of a comic wedding, another kind of a ritual celebration. But you see how fleshy all the people are? They're always all fat and odd-shaped and interesting in a way. Next, please. This is a peasant wedding dance. I just love the shape of the figures. They're like me. Big belly, fat, they must be the right way to be. Next, please. This is called the Fat Kitchen. Isn't this great? The Fat Kitchen. I really like this one. They're just eating, just lots of food, just enjoying themselves. Yeah, that's right. That's right over here. I didn't notice that. That's good. Oh, next one. Next slide. This is the skinny kitchen. That's where you had to go. See, this is too. Hardly there's nothing in there, and that's right. There's nothing. See, everything's gone. There's the fat one. I don't know what the fat one's doing. He's trying to get out of himself. I think. I don't know. Next one, please. She looked, for a moment she looked very stiff and prim, and then she replied, "Oh, poppycock." It was only when she heard his muffled laughter that she began to realize the significance of her own words. I presume the analysis, though, then took on a more enlivened, intimate, and honest quality, and transcending some earlier constrictions. When analysis works well, it's embodied, emotional, and at the best times, playful and humorous. It especially deals with the hearty, robust aspects of life, as seen in the Grotstein example. In such material, the earthy creativity of the individual manifests itself. Analysis shares a kind of underground quality with the carnival and with its out-of-the-mainstream values. It embraces the forgotten, the rich, neglected stuff that's been excluded and left out of psychological life. That's where the new life is. That is also why analysis has often been controversial, bringing so many attacks on Freud, Jung, and other people. There's a certain revolutionary aspect to analysis. At the same time, analysis must uphold, of course, the structure and values of boundaries and containment. In this way, analysis can be a creative combination of ritual structure and spontaneity, like a good festival, carnival and Lent, or whatever. A more detailed examination of the history of laughter can lend insight into our modern and postmodern times. We're swimming in waters we've inherited from the past. The most difficult thing of all is to recognize what's under your nose, which would be a very large and exaggerated nose from a Revelation perspective, even bigger than mine. Whence have we come? What have we lost? What have we lost? What might we regain? Beginning even in the 17th and continuing into the next century, there was a process of gradual narrowing of the ritual, spectacle, and carnival forms of folk culture. They become smaller and more trivial. The state tended to take over the festive life and turn it into parades. The state became very identified, of course, with organizing all aspects of life beginning in the 1600s and just increasing up to the present times. Charles Scott, philosophical anthropologist, has a wonderful book on that called Thinking Like a State. He has pictures of how the structure of cities changed and how forestry changed forests over time and stuff like that. Some festivals, such as ritual meals, were brought into the home and became part of family life. The state tended to turn things just into parades. The privileges for carnival and festivity, which were formally and officially allowed in the marketplace, were more and more officially restricted. The carnival spirit, with its freedom and its utopian futuristic spirit, which I think, you know, what we're struggling to do, or I am, is to get back into the spirit of that time. I mean, it was a very egalitarian feeling, you know, these festivals, everybody was equal to everybody, and everything was possible, and it was a certain kind of earthy idealism about it. And also the sense of the eternal generativity, that good things could be born, good things could happen in the world. It was transformed into merely a holiday mood. The public feast, as I said in the past, had been a ritual of renewal for people. Now it became a sort of private or even literary tradition, divorced from everyday life. During the Renaissance, compendiums of fantastic animals were very popular, while their festive expression and celebration steadily declined. The Enlightenment ideal was utilitarian and narrowly optimistic. It was dominated by lofty perfectionism and a belief that perfect knowledge was attainable through reason. Descartes called this l'esprit géométrique, the geometric spirit. That's still the motto of the French Civil Service Engineering Corps. And they tend to make roads go right through. They don't care who lives where or what it goes This geometric idea was not very compatible with the old worldview that took joy in endless transcendent creation and accepted chronic incompleteness. In addition, the religious reformers of the time, influenced by the rational perfectionism of Enlightenment philosophers, saw the work of the devil in the old carnival farms and in laughter itself. However, in writers such as Molière, Diderot, Swift, and Voltaire, the old views continued to have a similar function to the festivals of earlier times. They continued a carnival grotesque farm that functioned to bring inventive freedom and to bring together a variety of elements and experiment with them, to liberate the mind from the prevailing point of view, from conventions and established truth, from cliches, from all that's humdrum and just universally thought, the collective spirit. The carnival spirit still offers the chance to have a new outlook on the world and to realize the relative and incomplete nature of all that exists and to enter a completely new order of things. During the 19th century, the pre-Romantic and Romantics embraced the grotesque but with a different meaning. It became the expression of a subjective, individualistic worldview. We're very much like that now. Subjective, individualistic worldview, very different from the carnival and laughter of earlier periods, which was very social and kind of an immersion in nature and other people. Laughter and humor had united the community in earlier times, but now the enlivening vitality became an inner and somewhat private affair. However, the romantic sense of the grotesque was very important. It was a reaction to the rational and what was called the classical view of the Enlightenment. It provoked an alternative to the cold rationalism and the official formal dogmatism of the times. It was a rejection of what was finished and completed and the rational utilitarian spirit of that age, and our own age, certainly too. In its valuing of the inner depths and its strange fantasy images, the Romantic movement was one of the main sources of later theories of the unconscious and of modern depth psychology. I mean, modern depth psychology, you know, it doesn't exist in isolation. Just, you know, Freud or Jung didn't think up a bunch of ideas. It came from a whole intellectual, cultural atmosphere. Unlike the medieval and Renaissance grotesque, however, which was directly related to folk culture and heavily grounded in folk culture, the Romantic genre, as I said, had a private and chamber character. It became like an individual carnival, marked by a vivid sense of isolation often. The carnival spirit was often transposed into subjective idealistic philosophy. It ceased to be concrete, or one might say it ceased to be a bodily experience of the inexhaustible creativity of being, as it was in the Middle Ages and Renaissance. Laughter tended to become cold humor, irony, sarcasm. It ceased to be a joyful and triumphant hilarity. The positive regenerating power of laughter was reduced to a minimum, and its death-like derisive side became more predominant. Aggressive wit was lauded as the proper way, by the way, or the type of humor that was approved of or believed in or felt to be meaningful. This loss of the spirit of regeneration was part of the increasing sense of separation between self and world. Losing the regenerating power of carnival and laughter with its celebration of the ordinary and of the commonplace, the world became more dubious. Increasingly, it became a place of alienation, anxiety, and terror. Rather than delightfully and laughably renewing, the grotesque became a dreaded revelation of what lay beneath the everyday. In medieval times, laughter and festival could vanquish grotesqueries, and people were invigorated by the encounter. During the 19th century, the grotesque became the macabre, underground entities laden with fear and terror, as well as morbid fascination. The transcendent element was largely lost. During medieval times, madness itself could be seen as a revelation, oftentimes in the guise of the transcendent fool. This was a symbolic taking the blinders of normality off, a festive madness. During the later centuries, madness increasingly became a thing of terror and of cultural exclusion. Foucault has written about that, you know, the book Madness and Civilization. No longer having access to the regenerating power of carnival and laughter, the post-Enlightenment self often seems somber and tragic. A ritual way of joyously transforming the social isolation is lacking. The self-righteous seriousness of the modern person has provided rich material, though, for comic parodies such as Spike Jones from the 40s and 50s, the music I played as you came in. He called his band the Musical Depreciation Review. Or the contemporary wild humor of things like Saturday Night Live. Depth psychology and the practice of psychotherapy are the heirs of these worldviews. Freud wrote first about hysterical madnesses and then about dreams and their grotesque symbols. He mostly relegated meaning, though, to the inner world, to the id, the voice of necessity. Although Freud wrote a fine book on jokes and later mentioned humor in a positive light, he did not see jokes as regenerative, but as hidden expression of forbidden emotions. Later, he did describe humor as creative self-love, but this falls short of the view of laughter as dynamic and regenerative. Although Jung was known for his loud belly laugh and sense of humor, and I know Dieter Baumann, his grandson, once I was in a little group with him, was told stories how Jung was and how hilarious some of his behavior was as a grandfather. I don't think he was that great as a father, but once he'd mellowed in old age, he was a much nicer guy in that way. He didn't write about humor and laughter at all, although one place he does say humor is that truly divine attribute of man which alone befits him to maintain his soul in freedom. Jung mentions the loss of a sense of humor, too, in dementia praecox, that is, schizophrenia. In the rich panoply of symbols and archetypes, Jung and Jungians do place grotesque realities, very much like, I think, in the Rabelaisian way, at the core of their interest. You know, Jungians love bizarre symbols, and that's where the energy is. Right? It's very, very basic. There's a clear connection here to the Romantic tradition. There was a sense here, of course, of the regenerative depths of transcendence, both in Freud and Jung, but they also, I think, showed that still the individual isolation of the romantic. the psyche generally seen in separation from world and social relationships. And it's been up to the post-Freudians and post-Jungians to overcome, I think, this sense of the isolated, singular individual and place psychological experience much more back into the interpersonal world. Martin Heidegger began this task in philosophy by a return to Dasein, which is really a simple statement that what matters is being there, being present to what is without preconditions or judgment. Immanuel Levinas has carried this further with his philosophy of the infinite dimension of the other. These views, as well as those of other people, analysts, philosophers, so forth, give hope for a return to fuller sense of human community. In my opinion, the analytic milieu has long been dominated by an attitude of overburdened seriousness. Laughter, and indeed all positive emotions. I mean, you never hear anything about positive emotions at psychological meetings, you know. Excitement, joy, you don't hear much about those things. So those have even been looked upon with suspicion. There's a sort of morbidity, I think, almost. Humor and laughter, I think, could contribute a creative openness to that world, as well as a greater sense of communal connection. Psychological community badly needs a court jester. You know, Joe Wheelwright in San Francisco is an old mentor of mine. I don't know if you've ever heard of him. He was one of the founders of the Institute, but he was one of the few Jungians that messed around with the Freudians at that time, and he always liked to joke and say he'd been anointed as the Freudians' court jester, because he always brought in the unexpected and made them laugh. But several modern psychoanalysts have discussed humor, prominent among them being Kohut. He reformulated Freud's idea as follows. Humor and cosmic narcissism permit us to face death without having to resort to denial, and are based not on a letting go of the self through a frantic flight, but on a transcendence of the narcissistic self through a rearrangement and transformation of self-centered libido. The ego is not narrowed, but remains active and deliberate. That is, not regressed, not escapist, as was the old Freudian tradition, that humor was escapist, defensive, delusional almost. Kohut said the profoundest forms of humor and cosmic narcissism therefore do not present a picture of grandiosity and elation, but a quiet inner triumph with the admixture of undenied melancholy as well. So he takes humor out of the category of defense mechanism and sees it as probably the highest human achievement. He also, of course, mentions the inevitable admixture of melancholy that so often, like tears, accompanies laughter. In a very nice and interesting paper, in a lighter vein, Kohut discusses the Little Piggy children's story. And you probably all heard the Little Piggy story, you know, Little Piggy. This little piggy went to market. This little piggy went home. This little piggy ate roast beef. This little piggy stayed home. This little piggy went wee, wee, wee all the way home. And, you know, as she goes through each piggy, the mother gently pulls one of the child's toes. And the child usually looks, curious, attentive, but a little anxious. And then at the wee, 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 the mother swoops up the child in an embrace, and they have this hilarious shared laughter. And Kohut analyzed the story as follows. First, of course, the child must have an adequate level of development, or it would be frightened or cry. There must be some self-stability, or it would be too threatening. There's a bit of the abyss, a hint of possible fragmentation of self. Each toe is like a bit of self being playfully pulled apart. At last, however, the sweeping embrace restores the parts of the self. They are reunited in laughter, joy, and renewal. Note that all the elements of ritual laughter and carnival are present, too, in this small, delightful interaction, and it culminates in regeneration and renewal. Now, I'd like to just conclude briefly with a sample from an analysis from many years back in my career. This analysis was, Bill was a man in his middle 50s who worked with me for about 6 years, twice a week. He'd weathered a suicide attempt by one of his children, a very traumatic divorce, a bout with colon cancer, and had made profound shifts in his relationship to self and world. This was at the end stages of the analysis. These are two final major dreams I'll relate. He related this first one with an air of great delight. There are a couple of old men somewhere in a cabin, by a lake or in the woods. They are laughing and joking together, appreciating their lives and their successes, and just enjoying good wine, food, fishing, and each other's company. That was the dream. It's two old men just laughing and joking together. He connected this dream to the analysis and his general sense of peace about his life. Formerly a hard-driving businessman and a very successful one, he had cut down on work and was about to get remarried. He was taking more time for himself as well. In a word, life was indeed much more festive for Bill. He had not had much sense of humor when he first came to see me. He was tight and totally serious and rarely laughed. However, these qualities had emerged clearly in the analytic process, like in the dream. Like the two old men, maybe that was him and me, although I was younger then. But the emergence of a true sense of humor and a capacity to belly laugh is almost always a good sign that individuation is evolving. Absence is usually a sign things have a way to go. His last major dream was this one. Charlotte, his ex-wife, of many years' duration, Charlotte and I are hiking down by the bay. There are no houses or people around, as if there had never been any settlement. We get down into the tidelands, and I see a huge, beautiful shell in the muck. I ask Charlotte to come and see, but she isn't interested. The shell rises up in the mud and rotates. I see a living animal within it, and I laugh in sheer delight. Then I am walking alone in the dark, higher up in the hills. The sky is sort of lit up, and I see all sorts of prehistoric animals gambolling around, that is, playing around. I know they only come out in the night and go away in the daytime so that most people don't ever see them. He was very moved by this dream, and indeed teary-eyed as he smiled. But he said he knew that the dream, though, was a perfect statement how it had been with him and his ex-wife and how things had evolved. The terrible muck, the shit, the pain, the torment he had been through had borne fruit. The living thing had emerged as if from the basic power of regeneration intrinsic to life for this rich muck that he was exploring. After that, he can appreciate and see the playful pattern of things and these gambolling animals, and can, at least for a time, be aware of the being of each moment. Soon thereafter, he left analysis and has done well, so far as I know. I've gotten occasional cards from him, and it seems to have lasted. So we've traveled through chimps, laughter, humor, carnival, rituals. And in this fragmented postmodern era, we need all the perspectives I think we can find. All of life, including analytic work, benefits from being informed by humor and laughter with their earthy and fertile transcendence. Humor and laughter are essential elements of the human discourse and open the way for the diverse tongues of that discourse. In humor and laughter, we glimpse an underlying connection with being that people of earlier times knew through ritual enactments. If we keep such things in mind, perhaps the destructive aspects of over-seriousness can be ameliorated. Hopefully, we'll be able to create less tragedy and more transcendent celebration. I think we should think, may laughter free the many, many tongues to speak. Thank you. Beg pardon?
Did he see the shell as his shell?
It's his revelation, I think, more. Yeah. His shell, that's the guy. I never thought of it. Till you, him coming out of his shell. Yeah, I'm sure that that was there too. Yeah, yeah, that's interesting. I never thought of that. I'll catalog that away as a good insight. He did have a hard shell.
And his wife was not interested in seeing that shell.
Yeah. I presented this whole course of this analysis, but I mean, it was very difficult and stormy, and he was one of these driven people who was fiercely determined to make his marriage work and make everything be as it was, and he didn't want to look at anything that would disturb that. It was until he actually had a public fainting spell and was taken to the hospital when he tried to force himself to go back with his wife. He fainted right out and had a kind of a seizure-like episode. He was a very willful shelled person. And so there was that's good, yeah. He became at least soft-shelled.
And less gravity.
I was trying to get this whole thing, you know, these big, thick bodies and this kind of delight in just the grotesque shapes and, you know, all that kind of thing. You know, that was really, that was what I wanted to depict. I think their worldview, I think, was so different than ours. It takes an extreme act of imagination. You know, I think they were just dancing around and celebrating and, you know, the whole fool and jester thing, you know, captures the laughter and humor stuff more explicitly and concretely. But I was just so taken by this vast sense of dance and celebration that went on, you know, in many ways, 3 or 4 months out of the year in different ways. But there's always a tension between Lent and Carnival. Or, you know, there was this, I mean, I talk more about Carnival, but you can't ever see them in isolation. You know, they're always in tension with each other. So there was always a kind of a moralistic fear that Carnival would get out of line. So you do sense that kind of foreboding that's often there at the same time. And Busch and Bruegel both had a moralistic streak that comes through too. Yeah. I think there's some truth in that. I think it can become too formulaic, you know, to think that way, but certainly... it can be quite destructive, too, that when a person gets too, you know, too stuck in a Lenten mood, that's when they get possessed, you know. I mean, I'm sure that's, you know, like all this, you know, scandal in the, you know, in the Catholic Church with the priests. I expect that that's, you know, it's a very tragic and sad, but I think that happens. And on the other hand, you know, there's often a rebound from too much licentiousness or, you know, wildness, and people often then react to the opposite and become extremely rigid. I love AA, but a couple of my friends who went through AA became that way. They became, you know, kind of rebounded almost to the extreme opposite. It was kind of a brittle moralism. So I'm all in favor of AA, and they did great work, but so I don't know if things exactly turn into the opposite. I think there's, you know, there are more than two things usually. I think there's just a cauldron of different ways of seeing and experiencing, and sometimes you can get, I don't know about the polarities, I think Bakhtin used the term hyperglossia, many tongues, endless tongues, but I think any time we lose the voice of any single tongue and it becomes too repressed, and I think we as a culture are very serious, and yet we don't have much of a container for Carnival. I mean, you know, instead of have a Carnival here, you know, people get killed. I mean, there's no grounding in folk belief, or, you know, you know, we're kind of lost. So it's sort of like an antrodromia, but not, I have a problem with too much sense of just polarities working it out. I think it's more complex, that there's a whole cauldron of different forces that are endlessly in discourse, and it never gets settled, but it's the joy of that endless change and creativity that, you know, that really grabs me. To me, that's the transcendent element, is the sense of the eternal generativity of the endless process. Both individuals and culture, although I don't think you can totally separate them, you know, all are connected to all, too. Well, Francis Carnford wrote a wonderful book called The Origins of Attic Comedy, and he studied Greek comedy and tragedy, that historically, and I don't know if it's been studied in other cultures, but comedy far preceded the existence of tragedy in Greece, and it was connected with these fertility plays, you know, where there was death of the old and kind of a joy and rebirth and celebration. And then the specific figures of when city life and culture became more complex, tragedy came about with the exact same, there's a protagon and the antagon, I think, the antagonist and the, but there was no resolution. In tragedy, there's no resolution. So it kept the same form of the original comic forms, but there was no resolution and no celebration and marriage and reconnection of all the parts. So that historically, comedies almost certainly preceded tragedy. I think probably as a psychological attitude, that's also true. But certainly they exist together, and I think, you know, the just the very tension in wordplay, as I say, in humor, we become anxious. Because I think our words are very limited, and we can't contain much of life in our words, and we tend to believe that we're always in control, but we're really not, and the unknown surrounds us all the time, the unconscious, the unknown. And so I think stories, comic, humorous stories flirt on the abyss of the unknown. You know, it's that kind of, but we know, that's why it makes us anxious, but then there's a resolution. Oh, it's okay. You know, then we can kind of go on and be together. But so I think the tragedy, too, is something about the basic nature of our human limitation. Yeah, 925.
Thank you one more time.
Okay, thank you, thank you.
And that is the end of the tape. Copyright CG Jung Society, Seattle, and the speaker. All rights reserved. No copying, please.